And welcome back to the Pet Cash Pod presented by ProFluent Sports. As always, I appreciate you being here. I'm your host, Andrew Pet Cash. You can listen to all the other episodes at profluence.com/podcasts. We did an awesome one today with Scott Mendelson. He is the head of analytics at Duper, and also Tito Mochado. He is the CEO and president of Duper. If you don't know what Duper is, they are the scoring system across all of pickleball. We go into the logistics of how they've built it, what they're looking at, how they're integrating AI, how they're going downstream into college, pickleball as a whole and the growth that they've experienced, and then also their recent $8 million raise, which included an investment from the Rain Group and also famous racket sports star Andre Agassi. All in all, it was a great episode. Tons to learn and take away from this. Let's dive in. Ant Arena, appreciate you hopping on today. I must say, I always view my name as cool, but I think this might be up there on one of the top names of podcasts we've had on. So you'll at least come away with that. Hopefully it's a top downloaded one as well, but you definitely got top one of the top titles for names.
Have you got a trophy for that? Is that a...
We might have to add that. Maybe a shelf. Yeah, maybe a sticker or something. I don't know. We'll get there one day in the podcast world. But if you can just give us a little bit of your background first, how you got into the company Aura that you're building now, that would be amazing. And we'll pick it off from there.
Absolutely. Look, and thanks for having me on, Andrew. It's really great to meet you. Love the podcast. So excited to be a part of it. My background was, at university, I studied marketing and economics. I ended up working in ad agencies for probably just over a decade. And I think there's a common thing. Agency people get exposure to a lot of different businesses, a lot of different industries. But I ended up running an agency. I built my own agency. And if you're in a services-based business, it's hard work to keep doing that for well over a decade. And a lot of agency people tend to do is find ways to create products. And when you can create a product, then you build it, hopefully build it once and then sell it many, many times. And I'm just like, cookie cutter of that. The agency life got a little, sort of soul destroying, I think, in the repetition. And so I was excited about trying to create something from nothing. And so Aura started to evolve from that. The really quick story on the background was as an agency, we started to explore VR very, very early. We looked at building VR experiences on video game engines to create a 3D immersive environment. I mean, all this stuff is common language now, but in 2013, it wasn't when we started. We built these experiences, and the clients we worked with said that these are awesome because you're rather than 360 video, which was the popular thing at the time, we had a video game engine at the core. Allowed us to have a 3D space that you could now move through and interact and engage with. And so they said, okay, how do we distribute these experiences to more eyeballs? So I looked for distribution platforms and I couldn't find one. So, Aura basically, that was sort of the kernel of it there. And we decided to build our own platform. So we started in VR, and at some point, we switched gears and went to mobile, web, and connected TV. And it's funny now, I have so many people sending me all of the sports apps that are being done on Vision Pro in the last few weeks. And it was like all over the world, people I know like, hey, is this you guys? Because it looks exactly the same as what we were building in VR in 2017. that's the cycle of things. So we've been there and done that with the, what that stuff could look like. And I think where we are now and what we could do in Vision Pro becomes a really exciting thing for the future.
Yeah, and you touch on or a little bit, I guess probably better earlier rather than late to break down, what is the company now today? Because the VR was the entry, but it's much more dynamic and you got a lot of different things going on and across multiple continents. And we'll get into all that. But really, if you can just break down the company, what the real product is that you've built.
Yeah, I mean, over the journey, it's been an evolution of a product, which I guess it should be from a technology perspective because things change. And also, you start to try and put things out into market and you get feedback on, what people like and what they don't like. We made plenty of mistakes, by the way. Like, the first version that we built on Unity, when we put that into mobile, because we'd already built it in VR and we decided to switch gears, we wanted to keep as much as what we had built before. And we built some seriously cool stuff, and on mobile it looked incredible. But Unity does not work that well on mobile sometimes. You know, it can be pretty draining on the battery. We had to really try to optimize that, and we probably could have got away with that to some degree. But then when I was out trying to sell it to our clients, you know, to use that tech stack, they literally had to re-platform off most of the stuff that they were currently using. And the hypothesis we had was, well, this is kind of the next generation of technology and you have all these really cool features. But so I could get, you know, executives excited, I could get product guys excited, marketing team excited, and then I get to the CTO and they're like, no way. there's no way we're going to switch this over. And so we had to, you know, basically rebuild all of the front end, and at the same time, AI, the sort of rumblings of kind of, hey, this is going to be really impactful, I'm talking about 2 years ago. And we had a bunch of ideas in the space where we weren't really sure how we were going to build it, but creatively, they were in conceptually really cool ideas. And with the acceleration of all the AI technology, that opened up that door for us to say, oh, actually, this is how we can do that. And so we're in the third generation of the technology now. Our last version, I used to describe it as a video game that could stream content. That was kind of the positioning. It was kind of interesting for people to go, okay, that's kind of, talk to me more about that. Mm. But where we are now is so much broader. So, you know, if we'd started off as a kind of, you know, a streaming business, we're a hell of a lot more where we aggregate. We're more of an orchestration system these days. So on our logo, new website coming out next couple of days, you know, we have this little OS moniker, which stands for orchestration system. When you're orchestrating different elements together, the way we describe that is there's four buckets. There's content, which is the streaming side of the business. Data, so for sport, you know, what stats and player profiles and complex data visualizations, heat mapping, all sorts of really fun stuff. Community and social, fantasy, gamification of things is another bucket. And then monetization, so how do you generate new revenue streams? So we bring whatever a client has, whatever assets they have in those four buckets, and right now they're in different systems all over the place. So we bring those together. Our tech is kind of the glue that allows those to connect to each other. And then we fill in any gaps that a client has to deliver a next-gen platform. So, you know, on one screen, you can have content, you can have social integrations, you can have, can I buy the jersey, all that sort of stuff. And then we have an AI contextual engine called Constellation that can then power those experiences. So if you think of Aura as the glue and Constellation as the brains that drives that to reconfigure an experience on device down to an individual user. So it's sort of this hyper-personalization product. That's sort of it's a long-winded way to answer that, I'm sorry. Yeah. But that's a very quick version of the story of how we got from where we were to sort of where we are now.
No, I appreciate the context. And in terms of, so obviously you wanted to build the company, and I know you just explained the evolution, but what about sports particularly, or that component was interesting to you as an industry itself to build within?
Yeah, well, I mean, one, I love sport, big sport fan. I'm a huge NBA fan. I played a lot of basketball growing up. Actually, I think you played a lot of basketball growing up.
Yeah, I've been retired for a few years now.
I've been told I should retire many times. I'm getting way too old to run around these days, to be fair. So look, I'm a big sport fan, but also I understand that sport probably had a lot of issues. One of those issues is that you've got younger generations coming through that just don't consume the game in the same way. And there's a lot of stuff on the periphery around sport that kind of either is drawing their attention away from the game. Like there could be fantasy, it could be betting, it could be, you know, betting's obviously huge in the US now, all sorts of different things. And so the idea was, okay, well, how do we then aggregate and bring all those elements together to enhance the experience both for the user, but also for the leagues, for the brands that are associated, where you sort of can capture these eyeballs. And I guess tackling sport was a major challenge, and one that I think about often, was it the right choice, to be fair? Because it's hard to sell into sport. Like, there's long sales cycles, you've got to build relationships. It's probably even trickier as an Australian company trying to get into the US or get into Europe because you've got an extra kind of hurdle to get over there. But it's allowed our technology to grow in really, really cool ways because it touches so many of those different areas that I mentioned before. Lots of content, lots of data, lots of engagement in social media and e-commerce and fashion and all that sort of stuff. And then limited ways right now in which a lead can generate revenue because they tend to sell everything externally. So if there's ways to bring all that back together, now you can kind of get this 360 view of how any demographic, any particular user interacts and engages with the sport. And that allows you then to make decisions on how you can maximize the value in that moving forward.
Yeah, and you brought up the viewing habits, which technically I'm right on the border of Gen Z. And they always talk about my generation of, I mean, I still watch sports on TV, but I stream and it's different. But again, I'm on that fringe, so I'm probably not the best example even. But where do you see it going from here on out? And what do you see even like future generations beyond that? Because obviously you're trying to build into that basically, you know, mold of where it's going, not where it is today.
Yeah, I mean, like I mentioned, I think there's going to be some challenges for sport coming up in the next kind of decade or so. The games are changing, like sort of across the board. They're all trying to find new rules to make it a bit more exciting and interesting. I think the best way to get new generations to participate is to actually get them playing the sport. That's a fundamental. That's probably me as an old man talking, saying, you want your kid to love basketball? Get them playing basketball. You know, there's some stuff I see where some of the leagues are like, oh, you know, we'll turn the experience into a cartoon or something like that. And that might get the kids interested. But I don't think that's necessarily the right route to take. I think, you know, it's trying to gamify what the sport is actually about, sort of moves them more into a gaming environment and thinking, well, there's a better game over here I can go and engage with in terms of video games. Sorry, is what I mean by that. Where the leagues go over the next decade, it's going to be, you know, it has to be, what's the way I want to describe it? That they've got to think about the different touch points and then find ways to blend those together. And that's a big part of the problem that we're trying to solve for. So we think about if someone's massively into the data, we'll give them a data-led experience. Content will still always play a major role in that, but allow them to have that control over that. If someone's more into the social element or the fashion, whatever it might be. So like if you're, Andrew, you're an NBA fan, so wouldn't it be cool if I could just say, speak to the system and go, hey, what shoes is PJ Tucker wearing today and where can I buy them? And then you get that contextual information delivered and you can engage. So it's people are very fragmented in their consumption habits and the elements that they find interesting. And so how can you then serve to them an experience that engages? And one thing I think just to touch on with that is most product people will try and say, okay, well, here's a suite of personas for their fan base and here's user journeys. You know, it's a very kind of scientific approach and they pigeonhole people. And I think the way we think about Aura is that we want to build narratives that allow, and then as a fan, you find the narratives that you find interesting, whatever that might be. And, you know, when I talk to, you know, for example, the NBA, they'll say, oh, you know, a massive percentage of people that hit the app only see a small percentage of what's in the app. And so they tend to go to the same things all the time and that can become boring over time. So is there a way to allow these new narratives where you go on these kind of rabbit holes and journeys to engage a little bit more deeply? So building out stories is a great way to create human engagement and human connection. And that we want to use technology to do that, to try and solve some of these issues that are coming forward.
Yeah, and the tech can obviously be global, but you did mention some of the challenges expanding into new regions. Now, I know, and you might have to correct me on this a little bit, but it looks as if you have 3 offices now globally, a fourth coming in North America soon. You know, what does that process look like? And then also, what are your thoughts around actually putting real boots on the ground?
I mean, you have to do it, just as simple as that. So, yeah, we have staff in London. We have staff in North America, in New York. I say New York, she'll say Brooklyn, so I'll get in trouble on that one. But, yeah. And then obviously we're headquartered in Australia, and I think, you know, we've grown the business to a decent size over here. I think we're about 60 people. But the goal now is, and that was in the building phase of the technology. Now we're at the point of taking it to market and commercializing, you know, the tech that we've created. So now it is, you know, finding the right people in those key markets and getting them set up for success. That's always going to be a challenge, and having the appropriate funding to be able to front run all of that sort of stuff. But, you know, that's also the fun of the journey of doing something like this.
Yeah. And again, I mean, you know this, but also just recapping for anyone else, a lot of founders listen to this, always looking for, you know, tidbits to get ahead. You know, how do you approach that to go from, I'm sure it was sort of your idea, to now, you know, there's 60 people behind this vision. How did you, you know, go about that process to bring other people into the goal of what Aura can be in your mind, which I'm sure you think about every day?
Yeah, I think about it all the time. Look, no two people's journeys are the same. I think there's a lot of things that I hear in the startup world about, you know, you got to have create ideas, get good people around you, you know, get something out in market, test it. We haven't had the most orthodox path, to be fair. We've been a bit lucky with a few things where I got, you know, a reasonable amount of funding up front that from a media company that effectively walked away about a year later because they had a completely different shift in strategy. So that left me with, you know, a bit of cash and some ideas and the equity then to go and explore that. So, and that was right, you know, just before COVID. So I had a bit of time there and I had appropriate funding to sort of get us through that patch. That can be a bit of a poison pill though, because normally if you're trying to build something and you're VC backed, which we're not, we haven't done any deals with VCs.
So you're institution backed or privately angel sort of strategic funded backed?
Yeah, a handful of high net worth people and an Australian broadcaster now kind of involved. So yeah, a really unorthodox path, but the poison pill in that is like when you can go and build something, you know, like you have a very bold, large vision. Normally a VC will get you to cut that up into chunks and go and test some stuff in market. And we didn't have to sort of, I guess, worry about that. But maybe, like I said, it was a bit of an issue at the same time because we went, okay, let's build the big thing and try and, you know, aim, take the big swing, knock it out of the park was kind of the idea. Yeah. You know, in retrospect, there's probably some negativity to that, but I'm really happy that we've done it that way because I've met some other people in the industry that have tried to do the same thing that we've done, or something similar, and they've just ended up kind of reducing their scope massively where now, you know, they're doing some cool stuff, but it's kind of like really diminished for what the vision was because that's just where they found a little bit of market traction. And so if you're VC backed, they're gonna say, just focus there. Whereas we were able to kind of climb past those hurdles, build something much bigger, a lot more robust. You know, I say to our guys candidly with a smile on my face, I'm like, we're going to be a spectacular success or a catastrophic failure because we are going for the big prize. Like, I want to be the next big tech platform that can do some massive things. And sport's the first cab off the rank for us. You know, there's other areas outside in other industries where our tech can be very disruptive as well.
Yeah, when you think of those areas and the process to go explore those when you get there, what does that look like?
I mean, we're there now. So we're starting to deliver product, and that's just because of the maturity of the tech, by the way, but into insurance, into real estate, music and entertainment, travel, healthcare areas. Anytime you want to aggregate content, data, community, or, you know, interaction and monetize, we're a pretty interesting tech stack. And that's one of the things that we had to learn in building the tech along the way was build it to be as reusable as possible and build it to be as reusable or applicable into different industries to give you, you know, if the vision is to be this big tech company and not just a sports tech company, then that's what we had to work towards. And it's not easy to do that. Very difficult.
Yeah. And do you white label a lot, some of your stuff?
Yep. I mean, there might be some industries that we go into where we say, oh, we'll be the business, you know, we'll own the customer. It's not right. Like in sport, that's never going to happen, right? Because we don't own the rights and it's, you know, it's quite political, all sort of stuff. But there'll be other industries where we can create the tech, produce the business, own the business as a subsidiary somewhere else. And that might be an interesting path as a founder to continue to explore.
Just from a hiring standpoint and bringing new people on, what does that process look like for you? And how are you evaluating talent that you believe fits the mission and the vision?
Yeah, it's tricky. You know, I've really had to learn that lesson. I mean, when I worked in corporate, I don't know, like you had HR, you had people that would kind of like tick a bunch of those boxes, but when we're doing something like this, it's so important to get the right people. And we haven't got it right every time, by the way. I mean, there's, but when you do get it right, it's incredible. Like, I've had people that have been with me on this journey for like 7-8 years, and, you know, a whole bulk of them around 5. And so what I've found is that you can lean on the people that have been here a long time to make sure, you know, have them be part of the process for interviewing in certain areas. So, you know, we break the business up into commercial, engineering, product and design. And then there's sort of an executive above that. So I like to get, you know, if someone's coming on board or we have a role that's open, to meet with a cross-discipline so that they get a sense of, okay, what's it going to be like for someone in the design team to work with this new engineer, or for me to understand, you know, who this person is and what motivates them. And if they're, because I find there's two types of people. There's people that are bored, that just want a job and they just want to get paid next month. And then there's other people that are like really bought into the vision and they're like, I'm so excited about this product and I can't not be a part of it. So, and they're obviously the people that you want, right? They're the ones that kind of invest emotionally into the business and then they're along for the ride. That's what we look for.
You do a lot of traveling then with that, or do you have to touch point all over?
Yeah, I mean, you know, eventually hopefully I can scale that back a little bit. But at the moment, as we're growing the teams, you know, I think I had maybe 6 trips to the UK last year. The year before, I had like 7 to the States. You know, from Australia, I mean,
yeah, I was gonna say, you got some long hauls there.
A lot of everything's a long haul.
Yeah, nothing's close. You're just a big island.
Yeah, I mean, eventually I'll relocate. I'd planned to move to New York in April 2020, which is not a good time to be moving to New York. So I was over there, I think February, March that year, and then I kind of zipped back to Australia and the lockdowns. But that's on the cards that I'll relocate. It might just make it easier to be able to get around from out of Europe or wherever.
Yeah, and as we sort of near the end, I think something, and you talked about at the beginning, but coming from the agency world, there are, especially in sports, a lot of agencies from marketing to whatever it is, sponsorship. And just funny enough, I had this conversation a couple of days ago with a friend, but also similar aged person that was in charge of 150 sports clients in their agency, and only like 4 of them hit. And it was sort of what you were talking about of like this soul crushing, and even he's sort of looking for the next thing, potentially even thinking of starting his own thing. You know, what's sort of your advice to the people in those gaps of maybe looking for an idea or looking to jump, having gone through it yourself?
Yeah, I mean, they're just different business models, right? Service-based business, you're kind of always waiting for the next deal. You know, it's just kind of like you deliver something. So agencies are always, you know, probably 20% of their business should be thinking about new business and how do they go and pitch to new clients and win new work. That's the bit that gets, you know, it's fun when you're in your 20s and maybe into your early 30s, and then it just gets a bit tiring. So, and that happens a lot in the agency world. You start to realize that your time is valuable and that for you to get rewarded for that, you need to provide value to other people. And so then you start thinking in a product space, because products can apply a lot of value to a lot of different customers. And then for yourself, you can invest into one product or 2 products that can have those touch points. So you become an expert kind of, I guess, in that space. But an agency background is the best training, because you just, like, I'm talking about now creating a tech business that can work across multiple industries, because when I worked in agencies, I was exposed to multiple industries. Mm. You know, I worked on insurance clients and banking clients and automotive and all sorts of different stuff. So the challenge will be for anyone in that space is, I think it's great to go and cut your teeth in a services-based business. You learn the hustle, you learn all the skills that you need, learn to pitch, learn to sell, learn to be creative in your thinking. You know, you've got to be innovative to be able to kind of win those gigs. And then start to think, okay, how can you take your skills and your expertise and put that into a product that has value to the market? That's the challenge for anyone in my seat.
Yeah. And I know we've touched on a few things, but a question we ask everybody, any other trends, macro, micro, that you're paying attention to? And we'll make this a little more broad for you, but not just sports, but we'll even say in this fan engagement or digital type world that I would say you're playing in.
Yeah, I mean, AI is the big thing, right? It's very buzzwordy at the moment. The potential for just like massive disruption is so ripe. it's one of those things. I don't know if you've seen Sora that's come out. It's open, and the evolution of the technology and the pace at which it's changing, I think, will shock a lot of people. You know, we're at the bleeding edge of it. We're thinking about it in very different ways within our tech stack to how it can deliver very different fan engagement experiences. So, you know, there is a dichotomy in that, though, because AI doesn't always get it right, you know, in terms of you'll see things. And so we think about what's the blend of – it's a dichotomy of – AI curation for experiences, but then full control as a human to take that over if I want to, you know, I mentioned before about building narratives. So if AI is creating a narrative and I want to shift gears and go somewhere else, then I can have some level of control over that. That's how we're thinking about it. That's where we're seeing some massive trends is allowing both those things to occur at the same time.
I know what it is, but for anyone on the video side, if you want to just explain it quickly so people aren't just like, wait, what the heck is he talking about?
Oh, you're talking about with our stuff in particular?
No, Sora and some of the... Sora.
Yeah, so Sora's OpenAI, who are the guys that created ChatGPT. It's a text-to-video. So you just type something in and it produces a video. Now, there's a few companies that have been sort of trying to do this stuff. And as I mentioned, like AI, like sometimes it's a bit clunky, doesn't quite get it right. But the stuff I've seen from Sora is insane, the quality and height. You know, it just looks like it's reality. That's being filmed and being videoed. And that's going to be, you know.
And do you think from like, so video games have gotten exponentially better, but it almost seems like they're sort of at a plateau maybe where I haven't seen a ton of, you know, you look back to 2005 to now, it's like, holy cow. But the last 5 years, you're like, oh, it looks all pretty similar. Do you think AI will hit a plateau or do you think it can just like keep going? And then that's when we start to get to the ethical or more and you start to go, shoot, I really don't know what's going on.
I wouldn't call myself enough of an expert to kind of really dig into that. But as a human being looking at it, I think, you know, there's probably some minefield in the future that we'll need to navigate to make sure we don't go too far with this stuff. But in terms of its ability to change, you know, our lives, That's something I actually find quite exciting. You know, I mentioned before, like, you know, when there's sort of work that can be a bit soul-destroying or mind-numbing, you know, I love the promise that AI can help to, like, free people up to be a hell of a lot more productive. I don't think it necessarily will take a whole bunch of jobs, but it will allow people to be more efficient. So, you know, this is a pipe dream, but, you know, instead of working, you know, 50 hours a week, you can work 15 hours a week and get the same amount of stuff done and maybe life can shift a little bit. You've got to be careful because sometimes in capitalist societies, they go, well, you can still work 50 hours and you get three times as much done, you know, and trying to find a balance in all of that, I think it can give us a really interesting opportunity to explore our lives in really different ways. That's the hope and I think the promise of it. I'm a very typical founder. I read an article yesterday that we are unreasonably optimistic people. I think that's true for myself. So I always try and, you know, see the best in people and find the best, you know, and bring an energy to things that are with a positive lens if possible, you know, if I can.
No, I like that outlook. Now give us the socials, the website. I know your new one's going up. So for anyone looking to learn more about Aura and what you guys are up to, they know where to go.
Can do. I mean, the new website is aura-os.com. It'll be up in the next kind of 24 to 48 hours. So Andrew, I'm not sure when this is going to go live, but hopefully it's up by then. You'll find us on LinkedIn. I think actually that might be, and Twitter, X. You can tell how old I am.
Yeah.
And we're fairly active in that stuff. We're connect, you know, if you want to find out more about what we're doing, you can find me on LinkedIn. I'll be in the States, in LA, New York next week and the week after. So that's March, I think, 12 through 20. I'm speaking at the Sports Pro event in New York, going through some of the AI capabilities in our tech. And if anyone, any of the listeners are there, I'm pretty easygoing and always happy to have a conversation.
Love that. Well, Anne Arena, appreciate you hopping on today. I just like saying that name. Yeah, it's fun, man. Enjoy your, 15-hour flight?
To New York? No, it's about 23. Okay. I think it's about 13 to LA. But by the time you do the layover, I'm in LA for a few days, so it's fine. Yeah, we'll call it 15 to get to LA and then whatever to get to New York.
I love that. Well, have a good trip, brother.
Thank you, Andrew. Thanks for having me on, buddy. Appreciate it.